Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The case in front of us today is State versus Shane Kenneth Wallace, 821-0969. And the rules for the Zoom hearing are the same as if we were in court. You each will have 15 minutes with 5 minutes for a rebuttal if the appellant chooses to use it. And it is being recorded and will be posted on our website, so there should be no recording by anyone else other than the court. Please state your name when you begin your oral argument for the record. And with that, Mr. Hutton, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Judge Riley, Judge Smith, Judge Larkin. What I want to do is focus on the Sixth Amendment coercion constitutional right to remain silent argument. I think this is an important issue. As we all can agree, the Sixth Amendment right is a structural foundation necessity in any court case. Specifically, in this particular case, as the record reflects, there was one request prior to trial of the defendant to ask whether or not he would testify under oath. After much questioning and much dialogue on the record, the defendant stated that he did not want to testify. Then the questions came a second time in trial, again, he was asked whether or not he wanted to testify under oath at trial. He declined again. A third time, Mr. Wallace was asked, and in this scenario, this is where he stated that he did not want to testify. Then the Ramsey County judge, or the Dakota County judge rather, stated whether or not the prosecutor wanted to inquire. After several questions, Mr. Wallace then changed his mind and stated that he wanted to testify. The reaction from his defense counsel at that time was, "You're changing your mind." After Mr. Wallace said he wanted to testify, there was no further inquiry to determine whether or not this was an unintentional or a confusing right to give up. Now, Minnesota law, I admit, is kind of loose on this issue as a definitive stance on how far you can go with this colloquy. However, there's Supreme Court cases and other cases that I think this court can look on. And I think the court should look deeper into this. And the reasons is that, for example, the Supreme Court expressly refused to require district courts to perform an on-the-record colloquy with every criminal defendant who does not testify. That was State versus Wallen. Then as this issue started to be discussed throughout various courts, it was an overwhelming agreement that there should be some structural limitations of how far you can go, because those limitations seem to impede on a client's right to the Sixth Amendment to get a clear and understandable advice from counsel. And that's where we're at the intersection of this particular case. And the reason why...
just to go back just factually, because I think a lot of your argument rests on what you see as repeated decisions to remain silent that seem to be overcome then by the district court questioning. You started with the first one at the start of trial, and I just wanted to, so you name, I think, three times. And the first one is at the start of trial. When I was reading the transcript, I wasn't that clear that he had, that the your client had said he intended to remain silent. It was more about, was a decision made at that time such that opening arguments would reflect one way or the other? Are you saying, and the desire to preserve that decision until later, whether to testify or not? But you describe it as actually invoking the right to remain silent at that time. Can you speak to that?
Again, and that's a great question, because I think it does go for, number one, the understanding of where the client was at that time. The court, as the record reflects, demanded to know, the prosecutor also demanded to know whether or not Mr. Wallace was going to remain silent so she can adjust her opening statement for that. There was a discussion, albeit off the record, that he would. But what is important about that, Your Honor, is that there was advice and discussion from counsel that led him to make that choice. Now, as the trial did progress, they started putting these many occurrences on the record. But the case law is very clear, is that we should be very careful to go beyond one strategic request on the record where the defendant waived his right. So, Your Honor, you're right. And if I misspoke that it was on the record, my apologies. But I don't think it disturbs the fundamental notion that the defendant had a discussion with his attorney and affirmatively stated that he did not want to testify. And then later we see more questioning, more erosion on that, which seemed to appear question his own attorney's advice. And even on the record, Your Honor, his attorney even questioned, like, you know, after all our discussions and many times under oath where you testified that you didn't want to testify, now all of a sudden you do. And then I think what is more telling, there was no more discussions after that. And as the judge said, albeit with another example, once the toothpaste is out the tube, you can't put it back in. And I think at that time, it was just too late. But most importantly, where we have this fundamental constitutional right, where the courts, and this goes into the standard that you guys will choose to review, the first was their error. And we're saying that, yes, there was error with the amount of questioning and the colloquy that the courts around the country stated that you should not do. And the reason why that's a fundamental understanding where the courts don't disagree with one another is because they recognize that the Sixth Amendment is just one of those important rights that we just cannot infringe on. And this is not something where we can brush alongside of it or get close or even think about crossing it. We shall not interfere.
Mr. Hutton, yes, when I read through the transcripts, everyone initially assumed that your client was not going to testify. And it sounds like on Friday of trial, his attorney went through it. The prosecutor asked one question. The judge asked some questions. And at the end of that, he changed his mind and said, no, I do want to testify. And it sounds like the judge, or my reading of the transcript, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that they then took a weekend break, presumably to talk about it again and maybe to prepare him for testifying on Monday. And they come back Monday, and the judge, as I read the transcript, just wanted to make sure that he hadn't changed his mind again. Am I wrong in how I'm interpreting the transcript?
No, Your Honor, you're interpreting the transcript right. On Friday, they did take a weekend break, and then on Monday, they started. But however, Your Honor, I would kind of dial us back into when a court goes a little bit too far with the questioning with this right. And I don't think that's disturbed, because assuming that for the record, we can also assume that the defense strategy months before leading up to the trial, maybe even close to a year, that the defense strategy was for him not to testify. And so comparatively, it would be unbalanced. In particular, I still think that the three prongs with the error, that the error was is plain when you look at the Teague and the other case laws, Weber, the case law that's out there, it shows that this constitutional right was violative. And while so, Minnesota,
Mr. Hutton, I'm sorry, again, just to yes, follow up then, where precisely was the error? Monday, Friday, opening statements, when did it become error?
I think it becomes error, Your Honor, after the first question on the record. To do it over and
which
over.
Day? Maybe that would help, since there are like 3 days, I think, at issue.
So, yes, Your Honor, I would say, and, you know, going back into my note, when you look on page 7 of our brief, when they first asked the defendant on the record, has he carefully considered the advice of counsel, and you know it's your decision to make, true, that was on transcript 414 through 404. Then it goes into the next discussion where they go back on the record, and Mr. Wallace gets the questioning, and I don't have the exact date, but that's where I believe when the client first said, I do not want to testify, and I understand, and I'm thinking clearly, that's when you stop and go no further. And that, I believe, is somewhere on trial transcript 738 through 739. And it's very clear that Mr. Wallace did, in fact, make his decision not to testify. It was very, very clear. As a matter of fact, before that, even while this is through the discussions of his counsel, that has always been the plan to have that happen. Now, when you have more questioning from the prosecution, and then also questioning from Your Honor, who specifically says that once you do this, the tube is going to be let out. This is a perfect time for you to say yay or nay, but we're going to continue to ask you. I think, Your Honor, after that first time, that's where the fundamental right has been violated. And this is something, while I look at the case law, I interpret it to be is that you have to be very, very careful not to push. And so while, you know, let's provide the scenario in which this discussion comes in the same dialogue, where I ask the question over and over from three different individuals, whether or not you have waived your right to remain silent, a very sacred right to do. And I think after the first time, that's when it's gone too far. Even in the same dialogue, Your Honor, I would say that the courts even appreciate the fact. Even the cases where they didn't even overturn or send it remanded back to the new trial, for example, Weber even states that this is a right that they even believe should not happen, and that the courts and no one else should participate in any further colloquy.
Mr. Hutton, you have asked us to make a holding that it is error for a district court judge to inquire at all about a defendant's decision to testify or not testify. My reading of the case law is that while the district court doesn't have an affirmative duty to inquire, there's no prohibition in the case law about the district court making a simple inquiry. Do you have any cases that support your position that would prohibit a district court from making that inquiry?
There are no there's no case law that would prohibit a court from making the inquiry. But there is, and as cited, a bunch of case law that discusses when that inquiry goes a little bit too far. And that is very clear. And to the point, and I want this fact to be understood, is that where that intersection of where the client starts to disunderstand or detach from the advice of his counsel. And I think we do have evidence here where the counsel says, you're changing your mind after all this time. That's when the client starts to deter because of these questioning from the advice that he's giving. And that's why the case law was not even incongruent.
The record is silent about what advice the attorney gave his client, because both the prosecutor and the judge were really clear. We don't want to know what your discussions were. We just want to know that you covered this topic. So
respectfully, Respectfully, Judge Wiley, I would disagree. And the reason why I would disagree with that is when they asked, have you talking to counsel? And what is your decision? And he says, I choose not to testify. So I would respectfully disagree that we can assume that the counsel chose for him not to testify. And then that assumption is even bolstered by the fact that the counsel on the record, when Mr. Wallace changed his mind, made the excited utterance, you're changing your mind, which leads us to believe that there was discussions for them not to testify. And we have the opening statements where counsel himself on the record said Mr. Wallace was not going to testify, at least at that time with opening statements. I have 15 seconds, Your Honor. I will save the rest for rebuttal. Thank you for your questions.
Thank you very much. Attorney for respondent, get the time up and then you can start. There you go.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jessica Beerworth and I represent the respondent in this matter. I will begin by saying that the court's reading of the transcript, I believe, is entirely accurate in this matter. There is no prohibition against a district judge's inquiry into the right to testify. The right to testify is the defendant's choice, regardless of whatever assumptions appellate counsel wants to make about what trial counsel advised. And for those reasons, we know most district court judges certainly want to do their due diligence in making sure that a defendant is either exercising their right to remain silent or exercising their right to testify. And as already noted, the time frame here is of significance, that being the decision to testify, the weekend break, and then the follow-up to make sure that that was in fact still the decision. That I submit to you all is not interfering with any Sixth Amendment right. It's protecting an equally important right, that being the right to testify or remain silent, and it's due diligence on the part of a district court judge, given their assessment of the case, given discussions that they have heard that is before them. And I would strongly request that this court not create a ruling prohibiting a district court judge from making that inquiry. What I want to spend a few moments on here this morning, Your Honors, also is harmless error, and that as it relates to the relationship evidence of the pieces of this case.
I do want to turn to that. I'm happy to do that. I just want you to just fill me in just on the details of the trial. I'm sure I can figure this out if I look more closely, but the first conversation, what day did it occur on, and then was it at the close of the... I just put it in context for me, the three stages that we're talking about, if you would.
Yes, Your Honor, I will. And while I am in the same position that the court is in, I am relying on the transcript. I was not trial counsel. But the first occurred on a Monday or Tuesday when the court had convened. The second occurred on a Friday. And then the third on, as the court, district court says in its transcript, okay, well then I will expect that to occur on Monday morning at 10 o'clock, talking about commencement of the defense's case. So that is my read of that, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Turning briefly to the other issue, the circumstantial or direct evidence as raised by appellant, there are both in this case and there is sufficient evidence in this case. And that is why I would ask the court to find that any admission of any relationship evidence, if the court finds there was any error, that in fact it was harmless error, considering the sufficient amount of evidence, the corroboration of that evidence in the form of the victim and other family members be able to talk about how she behaved and the like, and also deferring again, as we do, to the fact finder in this case, and the reality being that that the court assesses the facts consistent with the verdict, and that the jury had to believe
that. Ms. Beerworth, yes. I see that Judge Larkin has her hand up.
I'm sorry, I'm not
question, Judge Larkin.
I'm not used to the judges raising their hands.
And I don't want to stop this argument. I have a question regarding the third issue, the relationship evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Could you tell me what the district court's basis for admitting the evidence is? And if you're not clear, what the state's strongest evidence or strongest argument is for the admission of evidence about the buttocks touching in the pornographic text, and explain to me the state's theory of why that's relevant.
Yes, Your Honor. The state's theory, I believe, was that it shed light on the defendant's assertion or allegation that this was a mistake, that this was something that someone else misinterpreted. I think that the state...
So if that's the assertion, does that mean it came in as Spriegel evidence?
Judge, to be quite frank with the court, I'm not entirely clear, even based on the trial transcript, if that is only how the court, if that is how the court admitted it, because the district court said it recognized that there were other fashions or other manners of relationship evidence outside of 63420 and outside of Spriegel.
Well, let me stop you there, because what I'd like to know is what's the state's best argument for admission? And what you just explained to me would fall under 404B, in other words, absence of mistake. So if that's the grounds for admitting the evidence, my next question is, were the procedural requirements of 404B complied with?
Your Honor, I think what occurred was that the evidence was offered by the state pursuant to what the state found to be a third category of relationship evidence outside of 63420 and outside of Spriegel.
Okay, let me stop you there, because the time is limited and I want to make sure I know how to think about this. Mm-hmm. Are you then conceding by your answer that there wasn't compliance with 404B in terms of the admission requirements?
Judge, I am saying that I understand the arguments offered at the district court level, and I appreciate that there are arguments contrary to those. And I certainly could see the court's position on that and the court's concern. I cannot give you a concrete answer on your question, to be honest with you, to be quite
okay,
frank
so then
with you.
Here's my concern. Mm-hmm. If there was no compliance with the requirements for Spriegel, because the district court and the state was thinking this isn't being offered under 404B, it's offered as some sort of relationship evidence, whether that's 63420 or the broader category of relationship evidence described in the case law, such that there need not be compliance with the Spriegel requirements, then give me the state's best argument why the evidence was admissible as relationship evidence or under 63420, since there presumably was not compliance with the 404B requirements. Does that make sense? That's
yes.
What I'm looking for.
Yes, it is. Your Honor, I would say that the state, the evidence or the argument offered was that this gave context to the family dynamic, that this showed that, again, it was a relationship throughout the family, because that was another relationship issue that was raised by the defendant in their theory of the case. But I know that the state offered and the court admitted, based upon what the court talked about as that third category relationship evidence. And that is why I'm also asking the court to strongly consider harmless error in this matter, because I recognize the lack of clarity on this argument, Your Honor.
Can you articulate for me, both under 63420 and the case law describing that statute, as well as the more general relationship evidence case law, how this fits? I'm having a hard time understanding how the two acts fit under 63420, because it's not clear to me that they meet the definition of domestic incident, or whatever the language is. Because in my memory, most of the cases involving 63420 are, well, there's an accusation that the defendant abused somebody, and then there's accusations that he's previously abused either that person or people in that person's family. And we could look at the evidence to see how he treats people in the family. But I have concerns that this evidence isn't really evidence that constitutes a domestic incident as that's defined. And then as far as the relationship evidence goes, I think, and I could be wrong, my recollection of that case law is it really is limited to conduct between the defendant and the alleged victim, whereas 634.20 allows us to go beyond conduct towards the alleged victim. And so it doesn't seem to fit there. So I'm sensing you saying, yeah, it's not a good fit. So then your best argument is probably going to be why this error was not harmless. And I'm struggling with that as well, or why it was harmless.
Your Honor, I don't disagree with the court's assessment. It does not fit the definition of family or household member as outlined in 518B. That is what defines 634. That's where 634 goes for its definition. I don't disagree with, I agree with the court on that regard. In terms of other relationship evidence, I think the court is also right in its assessment that the case law has historically indicated that relationship evidence, though not a household or family member, does typically involve the defendant and the victim. One of those cases, as cited, would be the Loving matter, where Mr. Loving murdered both Ms. Peters, who he had a child in common with, as well as Ms. Peters' new boyfriend, Mr. Allen. And under those circumstances, relationship evidence was admitted in regard to Mr. Allen, even though he was not a household or family member under 634. And though—
But in that circumstance, it's sort of like the second victim's relationship with the first victim brings it in the context of the relationship. And I'm not seeing that connection here.
And Your Honor, I do not disagree with you. And that's why I'm asking the
harmless
court.
Harmless error. Let's hear about harmless error.
Thank you, Your Honor. Given the amount of evidence that was presented here, this ties back into issue number one and the sufficiency of that evidence. The error is harmless because of the amount of information, the fact finder making the determinations, weighing the credibility, and the instructions given regarding that evidence that was offered. The district court was diligent in making sure that the jury was instructed how that evidence was not to be used to convict the defendant in this case. And we assume that the jury follows those instructions. That's what case law tells us.
And absolutely. I mean, I think what the district court instructs is he's not charged with any other conduct. So you're not to convict him based on those acts. But here, as you've indicated, this was a credibility determination as between the victim and the defendant, especially where the defendant testified. And it seems to me that the evidence of these two prior acts certainly influenced the credibility determination. I mean, if a juror is on the line about who do you believe, and now you hear, well, listen, what else this guy is up to? It seems to me that that's pretty powerful evidence, even though the district court said you can't convict them based on that evidence.
Your Honor, I think we have to trust that the jury did what the district court told the jury they could or could not do. And that is—
But then what was the purpose of the evidence? Why was it in there? If you can't convict based on that evidence, I mean, that to me says you can't determine he's guilty of sending this pornographic evidence, and that's why you should convict him of a crime. You're not supposed to convict him for other conduct. Even if they didn't convict him for other conduct, I'm having a hard time ignoring the fact that that other conduct probably had significant weight in terms of deciding who to believe. And it's my understanding that the prosecutor did go back and reference that conduct in the closing argument to the jury. And did the prosecutor do it in a way that emphasized it such that, you know, we can't say it's harmless? I mean, when we do a harmless error analysis, we can't just say, is the evidence sufficient to convict? We have to say, oh, is the evidence so overwhelming that this inadmissible evidence could not have impacted the jury? And I think what we have to ask is, without that evidence, is it likely that there still would have been a conviction?
And I would submit
to address that.
Yes. And I would submit to this court that, in fact, without that, there still would have been a conviction. I would refer the court specifically to appellant's brief, where it is outlined to have found the defendant guilty, all of the pieces in regarding the victim, not the other evidence, but regarding the victim and how old she was and where this happened and how it happened and the multiple times that it happened, that is in fact enough to maintain this conviction, even absent the other pieces that were offered in the matter. So I think that absolutely they're going through those piece by piece as outlined is going to reach a point to tell the court that this is enough. And that is my request to this court, is to engage in that analysis and to determine that any admission of those other two incidents was in fact harmless because of the fact that there was substantially enough information or a great amount of evidence to convict the defendant in this matter. So with that, I am going to stop because I'm not going to be able to finish another sentence before my time is up, absent any further questions from the court. Thank you, Your Honors.
Let me ask my colleagues, do either of you have any more questions for the state? The respondent, no. Mr. Hutton, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I do want to say this before, again, we're all in the same position. I was not trial counsel either. So we're in a perfect opportunity to look at this objectively. I will start my 5 minutes dealing with the issue I wasn't able to talk about in the first 15 minutes, and that's the lengthy discussion that the state had with regard to this evidence that was admitted with the pornographic images. When we look at the statute, it is plainly clear, and it looks like the state has conceded, that reading the plain language, there was just no cause for this. Trial counsel for the defense at the time, in fact, did object. What I also didn't see in the record, which we can objectively conclude, there was nothing in writing with regard to the 404B where this type of evidence should have been discussed 14 days before trial and backed up, if not oral, because the amendments or the discussion under the rule says you can give it in writing, but you have to eventually get it in writing. And there's a reason why these rules are in place, because once you kind of deal with discussions that this individual, Mr. Wallace, is a sexual deviant, especially in a case like this, and then to reference that again in closing arguments, and then to have the defendant waive his right to remain silent, I think there's no other way but to conclude that there's not that there is error here, and the error is not harmless. It's in fact significant.
Counsel, could you was there an objection to the other act evidence at trial?
In the pretrial, yes, Your Honor.
In the pretrial. Okay, so this was litigated, and I thought I heard you say there was no objection. So this was litigated and decided before pretrial. So there was an objection. The issue is preserved. We're not dealing with plain error.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Could you discuss for me application, assuming this court were to decide that the admission of the two prior acts concerning the sister were an error, could you discuss whether that error was harmless?
Yes, Your Honor. And the error was not harmless. And I think we can conclude, number one, based on the allegations of why the client was here. He was here on three counts of sexual misconduct. And this evidence that was entered, which had nothing to do with domestic abuse or the relationship, it painted the individual as a sexual deviant. And while there's instructions from the judge that address this, the jury heard the evidence. evidence, we have to assume that they considered this evidence that should not have been allowed. And for the prosecutor to then focus on this, at least in part in her closing statement, I don't think it's a stretch to conclude that this was not harmless error, but in fact, it was a significant error in which violated the fairness of Mr. Waller's ability to defend these claims in court. And this case is a sensitive case for all of us, I, no matter who you are, and I would admit that as a human being standing on this, but as a lawyer, our job is to ensure that we look at the black letter of law and the fairness of trials, because without that, we then go off the guidance of what we're having to prove. And with that, Your Honor, I think the crucial determinations, while I didn't talk about the circumstantial evidence, I will concede. I think that's kind of a very small issue. But the two issues that I would have you focus on, think about, is the erroneous waiver and coercion of the Sixth Amendment right, which interfered with his ability to listen to counsel. And I think the case law is clear on that. And in particular, the significant error that is prejudicial with regard to letting in evidence that should have been precluded, that was objected to, that the state obviously found important enough to underscore in their closing arguments.
Counsel, how did the state underscore? Do you have a memory of the transcript? Give me an example. What did the state say to the jury about, here's why this evidence is relevant to your decision? What was the argument?
Your Honor, I don't have memory on that, but I do know
that. We can check the transcript. Thank you.
I do know it was addressed.
Thank you to both of you for your briefing and your arguments. They are helpful, and we are going to recess and conference. We'll have our decision out within the 90 days. Thank you very much, and have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.